Welcome to a podcast of a sermon delivered at the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood in New Jersey. Our congregation is a place where you will find inspiration in the richness of diverse beliefs and the power of community. Detailed information about the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood is available on our website, uuridgewood.org.
So someone once asked me to name one thing that I could change in the world without effort. She was trying to get to know me, I think, and it was a pretty simple question. She expected me to say, and I did say, something along the lines of world peace. And because of the crowd that I run in, that's a pretty common answer when I ask this question. Other people say things like smash the patriarchy, or replace global capitalism with a system that equates fairness with equity and everyone having enough. That one usually goes on for a while. But these are the types of answers. Occasionally, I will get like a put chocolate milk in the soda fountains or something like that. But the most interesting answer, and I have to say that I'm incredibly biased, the answer came from my wife, and she said, I would want to make people 10% more compassionate, which seemed weird. Like, why 10% more compassionate? And she countered with, well, basically, there are some people who are compassionate enough that any more compassion would kill them, and they're really doing just fine. But the vast majority of us could stand to be a lot more compassionate. And so that 10% on average is sort of an average of all people, but also she posited that if people were just a bit more compassionate, it would reap huge rewards, that it would fundamentally change the way we were together. And so I started to think about this a bit. I mean, what does compassion really mean anyway in this context? It doesn't mean just to be nicer. It never means to just be nicer. It doesn't really even mean to be just kinder, right? Those are great things. Those are wonderful things, and they too would surely transform the world. But it feels a little bit more complicated. When I thought today about what it would mean to come and talk about compassion, I have to do that in the context of knowing that this week we're talking about nuclear war. And this week we are talking about white supremacy, not just the kind that lives in our bones and that is enacted in our world in small ways that are amalgamated and make huge differences, but also the kind that shows up with tiki torches and runs cars into crowds of people. So compassion can't just mean to be nicer. If it's meant to be something meaningful, what are we talking about here? And so this root of compassion, the word meaning with the pain of others, has always given me a lot of questions more than answers. It's a powerful concept, the idea of compassion being literally with the passion, with the pain of other people. But to feel the pain of another is such a difficult hole to climb down into. Frederick Buechner said that compassion is the sometimes fatal capacity for feeling what it is like to live inside somebody else's skin. It's the knowledge that there can never really be any peace and joy for me until there is peace and joy finally for you too. Which all sounds great, but that sometimes fatal capacity part really gives me pause, right? And again, we go back to some people really don't need to be more compassionate. There is a limit to what makes sense for us. And as a faith, we do not believe in a sacrificial kind of love. We do not believe that in order to transform the world, you need to use yourself up. For a couple of years, I worked as a chaplain in hospitals and in transitional housing. And people would ask me after long days of talking to people, how do you do that? Isn't it too sad? Doesn't it weigh you down too much? And depending on how much I wanted to talk to someone, I would say, it's my work or something simple like that. But the truth is that it often was really sad, and it often was really heavy. And it didn't mean that that was a reason to not do it. In Manhattan, there's a large church called All Souls, and every Monday night they run a hospitality program, a program that feeds about 400 people. And George Collins, the man who runs it, has overseen it for the last 14 years. And in that time, he's seen it grow from being a program that feeds people, which it still does, but also one in which he's been able to bring in a few social workers to connect people with other social services and provide them with letters of reference. But when you ask him about his work, he'll start talking about those changes and saying how far they've come over the past 14 years and how powerful that's been and how they're able to provide something concrete and direct and also something that people can take with them when they go. But if you get him speaking long enough, and really that just means if you listen long enough, because George is really excited to talk about All Souls, and he wants to share it with you. He'll also start to let his heart break a little bit. He'll talk about how on cold winter nights, when he has to close the doors of the church, that breaks his heart every week. He says that it's so sad to ask them to leave. And after 14 years, he's looking for a successor, but he's still doing it, right? There's a story that I had always heard of as a story that the rabbis told. I thought it was a story from Jewish literature in some way, but I've recently also heard it in the context of a Buddhist monastery. So it's either a story that the rabbis told or a story that the monks told. And I don't know which it is. But in any case, a woman comes to the rabbis slash monks and says, I want to know about this heaven thing. I want to know about this hell thing. I don't really know what either of them are about, and I'd like to know more about them. And they say, great, we will show you. And they snap their fingers. That was really good for me. Usually I make other people snap. And they snap their fingers. And the woman is transported, and she finds herself outside of double doors, much like you have here. And inside, she can hear dishes, she can hear plates, and she can smell wonderful food. All her favorite things, all of those aromas, are combining in ways that she didn't think possible, and also in real life would not mix well together. She has a very diverse palate, and in this case, they blend beautifully. And so she enters in, and the lights are glowing, and there are people sitting at long tables full of wonderful food. And then she looks a little bit longer, and it's quiet, and everyone's incredibly gaunt, and nobody's eating. And she realizes that they all have spoons that are arm length at least, you know, 3 foot long spoons. And they can't bring the spoon, their spoon doesn't bend, they can't bring it to their mouths. So they have all this luscious, rich, beautiful food in front of them, and they can't feed themselves. And she's sitting there, and it's too much, it's too sad. And she asks the monks slash rabbis, she can't stand it anymore. She gets that this is hell, but she needs to see heaven. She needs to see something different. And so they snap their fingers again, and she's transported again just right outside the double doors. And again, she hears the dishes, and she smells those wonderful smells again. And she gets nervous because she asked to see something different. She wanted to see heaven, but they seem to have brought her to the same place. So she walks in, and she sees the lights glowing, and she sees those same darn spoons, those extremely long spoons that people cannot feed themselves with. But people are eating here. Everyone feels like they're having a good time, and they look like they're well-fed, and she sees instantly that there's a massive difference between this room and the room that she was in last. Those same long spoons hadn't changed, but people had learned, instead of bringing the spoon to their own mouths, that they could bring it to that of their neighbor, that they could be fed by their friends. I don't know if that's 10% difference, but it is a very small difference that makes a world of difference. I think about that woman who was transported to those same doors, who smelled those same smells, who saw that same candlelight, and walked into those doors again, hoping for something different. Compassion isn't about pity or charity. It's not about self-punishment or self-abnegation, but it does require us to go out and confront our anxieties. There's physical courage that's involved, and when I think about the people who showed up in peaceful witness in Charlottesville, the people whose bodies allowed them, whose financial situations allowed them, whose families and friends were able to support them to show up, to engage in that sort of witness, as well as all the people who also supported that type of witness. That's a physical courage that's required. But there's also an emotional courage, this idea of being able to move into areas of deep suffering and pain is no easy task. And for those of us who are able to do it, sometimes it's just too easy to get lost in our own very basic emotions, to be overwhelmed by the pain of others and take it on so that it's paralyzing for ourselves. We can become personally distressed. So how do we move from that discomfort and that inconvenience and let our heart be broken, but not allow that to sideline us? The Reverend Christana McKnight of the U congregation in Taunton, she speaks about the social justice ministries of that congregation. And when she arrived 5 years ago, there were 12 members. It's grown considerably then, and a lot of that growth has been fueled by the fact that they've started a homeless ministry there. And a lot of people have asked her, because in our denomination, we're excited when congregations grow, we're excited when people are attracted, and we want to know, well, what is it that brings them here? And they ask Christana, and she says, well, we looked around, the 12 of us who were there, and we asked, what's calling to us? For whom does our heart break? What sort of work would we like to be doing? And what sort of community would we like to be? What moves us on a deep emotional level? Because compassion and social justice are not just for other people. They're for us, and our humanity depends on it. Our communities depend on it. So that's how we started, she says. The Dalai Lama says, if you want others to be happy, practice compassion. If you want to be happy, practice compassion. And if the Dalai Lama is not really your speed, I have scientific studies. So practicing compassion, whatever that might mean, people who practice it, who find that they are able to imagine the pain of others and then are moved to do something about it. In laboratory settings, they produce twice the amount of DHEA. It's a hormone that counteracts the aging process. It actually keeps you younger. And you produce 23% less cortisol, which is the stress hormone. It's not a bad payoff for 10% more compassionate. And so if we can return to the Dalai Lama for a moment when asking about what sort of compassion we might practice or what that might look like, I return to the monks / rabbis, the priests, the humans who have been practicing compassion for millennia, who have been working out ways for us to try to live into the pain of others without being overwhelmed by it. And so both contemporary science and the fields of psychology and mindfulness, but religious traditions as well, they point us to the idea that the cultivation of compassion is something that has to be done on a daily basis. It's something that We feel moved by sadness when tragedy happens. This week felt heavy for me, but the movement to do something with that is something that needs to be practiced even outside of these hard weeks. And so I offer a few ways we might go about doing this, a few rituals, if you will. I don't do this one, but it's extremely easy, and I can't imagine why I don't do it. It's really as simple as saying that you plan to be more compassionate, to wake up each morning, and before you leave the house, say to yourself, you can call it setting an intention if you wish, that you plan to be more compassionate, that you plan to see the pain of others more. At night, you might do something a little bit more intense. The Jesuits, Catholic priests who follow the writings and monastic order, priestly order, set out by St. Ignatius, they use a practice called the examen. And it's a five-step process that's rooted in Catholic theology. And I am not rooted in Catholic theology. And I find the examen to be an incredibly rich spiritual practice, where I lie awake at night, not for too long. And St. Ignatius actually says that if you fall asleep doing the examen, that's probably the best way you can fall asleep. So don't worry about it. But you start with just settling down, being aware of connections. And you can choose what those might be. For some, it may be God. For some, it may be the person next to you. And for some, it may be the next breath. But be aware of your own presence, and be aware that you are not alone in that. And you review your day. And you see what happens in your day. You find a place where you didn't quite live into your values. Now, even on the very best of days, we can always find one way in which we didn't quite do the thing we had hoped to do or be the person we had hoped to be. And we pay attention to our emotions. And then we shift to another moment where we lived into our deepest sense of selves. And even on the most horrible of days, there is something. That's not always easy to see, because for some of us, those days are hard. But there's always something. And you hold that moment, and you look to bring it into the next day. And that's the examen, or something like the examen. But a morning and a nightly ritual are ways in which, for millennia, people have been cultivating compassion. There's another five-step process that I like to use. And some use it as a mantra when you find yourself faced with a person that you would like to have more compassion for. I find I'm not very good at that. When I am annoyed, this is not what comes to mind. But I'm working on it. And I'm going to make you all work on it with me. So I want you to find someone sitting next to you. So that might mean that some of you have to move around. And I will wait until you find a partner. So find yourself a partner, or it can be a three-person group. That's fine. But go ahead, find yourself a place. This is not rhetorical. Thank you all. Okay, so depending on who you've sat next to, you might know that person, you might feel a need, you might have something particularly in mind that you would like to be more compassionate about with them. Or maybe there's someone you just met, and in that case, you probably still could have a little more compassion for them. So I want you to look at that other person And you're going to repeat after me, even if you don't want to. You're going to repeat after me, just like me, this person is seeking happiness. And if you can bear it, try to look at that person as you're saying these things. Okay. Just like me, this person is trying to avoid suffering. Just like me, this person has known sadness, loneliness, and despair. Just like me, this person is seeking to do better. All right, one last one. Just like me, this person is learning about life. All right, well, thank you all. And that is totally fine if you want to go back to your own seat. We are always in process. So the final thing I want to say about recognizing how to be more compassionate in our lives, how to bring that into our daily practice, is that we recognize it as a process. That there are times where we won't live into our deepest selves. And there are also times where that emotional overwhelm of other people's pain will grab hold of us in ways that feel too deep to move. And we can do better. In the words of Joy Harjo, we were never perfect, yet the journey we make together is perfect on this earth who was once a star and made the same mistakes as humans. We might make them again, she said. Crucial to finding the way is this: there is no beginning or end. You must make your own map. Amen.